Good morning. I call the Human Services, Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present, and we have got a long list of agenda items. Mr. Chair, I assume you are the first person to be here today. Have you had a chance to look
at
the minutes?
If not, I will take credit for it and move the minutes from March 24th, 2026.
Chair Schumacher moves the approval of minutes for March 2024. Any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are now approved for March 24, 2026. With that, we begin with House File 4210. Chair Fisher.
Hi. Good morning, Chair Noor, committee. I'd like to move House File 4210 before the committee.
Please proceed and introduce the bill.
Certainly. House File 4210 is a bill that helps address the issues around senior nutrition policies here in our state. What it does is, first of all, changes some of the terminologies that we would, instead of using the term seniors, use older adults. That is the more appropriate language. And then it would expand the use of state funds, which would give meal providers the ability to partner more broadly with providers to help provide additional flexibility to provide nutritious food for older adults. The Federal Older Americans Act funding for this program supports only prepared meals, and state funding can provide much more flexibility. And that additional flexibility in the proposed change will give providers across the state, providers like Metro Meals on Wheels, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Services, the opportunity to partner with farmers and food shelves to bring food to older adults. The demand for home delivered food meals is very high. And for people receiving the service, it is often that they only get one meal a day, and that these older adults receive, and they have additional food needs during the week. This would help address some of the nutrition risks that they would face. The bill also recognizes existing coordination with health and long-term care systems, emergency preparedness entities, and others, as well as specifies that the state funds can pay for medically tailored meals and other appropriate services and tools, including technology that would strengthen the program. The current funding does not meet the needs of the older adults we have as the needs have evolved over time, and this bill can help stretch the dollars that we have just a tiny bit. With that, I do have two testifiers with me here today.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I invite the testifiers to the table. Good morning. Please introduce yourself on the record and proceed.
Good morning. Don Simonson. I'm the Executive Director of Trellis. We're the Area Agency on Aging for the Metropolitan Region. Committee Co-Chair Noor and Committee Co-Chair Schumacher, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Area Agencies on Aging and the Senior Meals and Services Coalition. And we are very grateful to our lead author, Peter Fisher, for bringing our request to you today. So House File 4210, right, aims to really update the language for the Senior Nutrition Program. It's a very important program here in Minnesota to help older adults live at home. It'll clarify the statute, modernize the language, and support efficiency and innovation at the local level. Now, these changes are requested by a broad coalition of area agencies on aging and senior meal providers from across the state. As a network, we serve older adults who are low income, at high nutrition risk, and have difficulty with daily living activities. Now, in 2025 alone, our network served over 16,000 people with home-delivered meals. And these meals help older adults who live at home meet their needs for nutrition and stay connected to the community. A home-delivered meal brings both food and helps to address isolation. Congregate dining also does the same. Now, area agencies on aging, organizations like mine, we have seven in the state, administer the state funds appropriated for the senior nutrition program, and we have strong policies and procedures in place to prevent and detect fraud, and they include risk screening of providers prior to contract award, verification of services delivered, reconciliation of expenses against financial documentation and evaluation for performance outcomes. Now, the proposed modification to the program statute will support providers to build new partnerships, efficiently tap into other community resources, and most importantly, help older adults at high nutrition risk experience better health and lower their risk of hospitalization and costly Medicaid-funded long-term care. Now, the changes will codify the existing practices of coordination and will further allow providers to deliver food that would be helpful and useful to older adults. These might include things like food boxes, prepared meal kits with all of the food chopped up in advance, and certainly fresh produce. So thank you for hearing our bill. The changes we seek will increase access to food for older adults across the state who face malnutrition. This is an important step to strengthen the senior nutrition program. And as Representative Fisher said, these measures to modernize the statute are important, but they do not address the program's need for additional funding to prevent reductions in meals. We predict, or we project, about 451,000 fewer meals served this next year compared to last year. The one-time funds appropriated in 2023 have been exhausted, and the need grows along with the cost of food and labor. So we hope you will support our request today and also hear our request for additional base funding in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Simonson, for your testimony. We now move to the Ms. Lund. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Co-Chair Knorr and Co-Chair Shoemaker. Thank you for having me. My name is Stacey Lund, and I'm the Director of Food Access at Catholic Charities of the Diocese of St. Cloud. And we serve 14 counties in central Minnesota as a senior nutrition provider. On behalf of not only Catholic Charities, our Senior Meals and Services Coalition, but I'm also here representing the Minnesota Association of Senior Nutrition Providers. And many of us, we have the same struggles across the state. Ms. Simonson mentioned the changes to the language and some of the innovation and efficiencies that this may provide to us in order to serve more than a meal to the older adults that we serve across the state. Particularly in our rural communities, access to food is more and more of a challenge. And we all know that seniors and older adults, preferably, would like to be living in their homes in their rural communities where they have lived, where they have raised their families, the places that they call home. In these rural communities, access to food becoming more and more of a challenge, with some places have 30 miles for a grocery store that they have to travel, and our seniors slash older adults are more and more living in these rural communities without their families who have moved to other locations or informal supports for them. Many of the home-delivered meals that we provide are given, and we know that these people are telling us it's the only meal that they have in a day. And knowing that they also have a challenge of getting to a grocery store or having food access, providers would like the opportunity to provide more than a meal. Our current contracts with our AAAs are only for prepared meal, one meal a day, and that is not enough to meet the nutritional needs of the folks that we serve. And so we're asking for some innovation and some ability, some statute language changes that would allow us to provide produce, to also be delivering other groceries to these individuals, and in an efficient manner where that does not require a separate contract or funding stream in order to do that. And so that is really what this is about. We know that at Catholic Charities, we have seen, I came before the same group last year asking for this innovation and in the language, and we weren't allowed to do that because of the clarity that we needed with the statute. So I'm asking for your support in order for us to do this. We know that we have opportunities in rural Minnesota, particularly, to try to stretch our dollars and to be more efficient to meet the needs of our older adults. And we would like an opportunity to be able to do that, whether it be pilot opportunities to serve. We find particularly that older men who live in rural Minnesota may not have cooking skills. And so in order, you know, opportunities to be able to teach them and to provide some other resources. Also, our ability to be able to deliver food boxes and other, and to use our existing resources that we have access to, but to also use the funds that come through senior nutrition to address and to do that work. And so we do important work, and we need to have some resources and some structures in place that support that and allow us to do it efficiently and effectively. Last year at Catholic Charities, we experienced funding reductions that required us or pushed us into a situation where we served 1,458 fewer older adults than in 2024, and 92,222 fewer meals were also served in 2025 versus 2026. Ms. Simonson mentioned the expected or projected fewer meals that will be served across the state of being 451,000, and that includes, you know, not only us here at Catholic Charities, but obviously providers across the state, and that is a significant number of meals, and the 6,100 fewer older adults that are also expected to be served. We know that the needs are increasing, and as funding reduces, we need opportunities as providers to meet the needs of the older adults that we serve, and to do that in a way that is going to allow us to stretch our dollars and be efficient and effective. So thank you for hearing House File 4210. The changes we propose would strengthen senior nutrition programs across the state, increasing access to food for older adults. Thank you for listening to my testimony. I urge you to pass House File 4210 in support of Minnesota older adults and the providers who do this important work.
Thank you, Ms. Lynn, for your testimony. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify? Seeing none, we now move to member discussions. Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I read in here that one of the changes could be that we could tap into the food shelf food bank system and have some food for these older residents. And I really value the work that's done. I want to make sure to say a lot of these older people, the home delivered meals is kind of their wellness check for the day. Mm-hmm. Might be the only visit they get day in, day out, very reliably. And so the value of this is enormous. It goes way beyond nutrition to the total care of that person. We heard a bill in the Ag Committee to try to bring some more help to the food shelves also, mm-hmm. in terms of dollars to help supplement them. You know, there's a bill also to help the food banks that we're going to see if we can get it to go. Do you have any concern through all of this that if we open it up to the food shelves and food banks that those folks might see a drop in their inventory? And what do we do about that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Fish.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Thank you, Representative Gander. I think the thing that we have to take a look at is that right now the needs we have are currently going past our resources across the system. And what we have to do is figure out what we can do to help make our current resources more flexible. I think that the food bank system is an important part of it, and some of the same people that are in the food bank system eventually end up in the senior nutrition program. And so it's one of the things is this would help make it a little bit more seamless, make sure that they're getting the nutritional food that is not, an example, like fresh produce. They aren't always able having that through the meals, what I would call the Meals on Wheels program. But this would be able to bring that in and be able to have more of that type of food on a regular basis throughout than just the one meal a day. And so it does put a little bit more strain on the system, and it's important for us to find ways to figure out how can we strengthen that system more.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good.
Vice Chair.
Oh, me. Which Vice Chair? Right? Okay. Okay. Thanks, Chair. I love that you brought up the food shelves, food banks, because I think I've done a lot of work around food. Thank you for bringing this bill. In rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota, we do know that, like, one of the things we talk about a lot is how do we keep our elders, I call them elders, I think it's the most respectful way for us to incorporate the beauty of what they bring to our community. But our elders want to stay in their home as long as possible. And food access is one of the major parts about this. But I just want to remind us on why this is important and why tapping into other areas is hard. 3 years ago at the federal level, the senior SNAP was reduced by half. Here in Minnesota, we decided it was important to pick that up. So we met that match. So we were leaning in there, but also we've done a lot of work about food shelves. Food shelves and food banks are very different. Mm-hmm. Food shelves are in every single county. Food shelves by statute says that anybody comes in is required to get 6 pounds or 2 days worth of food. That's not really enough to sustain, like, feeding somebody long term. Food banks are a jumbo system that still pass the buck to our smaller communities. If you look in your community at anybody who's taking deliveries from food banks, they're typically charged the freight for that, or they have to deliver such a large capacity of food that our smaller communities don't necessarily always have the storage to keep that food. And so partnering programs like this individualize how we can get food to people. And food is medicine. You said it so well that food, it's more than a meal. Like, it's not only keeping our elders in their home, it's keeping our elders healthy. Like, what we put in our body helps us stay healthy. And so I think this is it's a good layer to what we have to do in the mix of the puzzle to continue to care for our elders in the very best way that we can. Having the transportation component, bringing the food to our community is also really important, not always assuming that people can get to a brick and mortar to pick up their food or that time frame works for everybody. So thank you so much, Chair Fisher, for carrying this, and thanks for the work that we do. Hopefully that was helpful in leaning into a little bit, too, of the differences and why we need to partner with something like this and the already growing need. We saw in food shelves in the last 5 years, the number one population that's growing is our elders. Okay. And they're first-time users, which means they've gone their entire life never needing food support. And now when they're on a fixed income and we're seeing these reductions come, it's just required that we do this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keelan. Now to Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And a couple of quick questions. The bill introduces funds that can be allocated to tools and technology. I just wondered if you could explain that a little bit more, what that the funding source would be going towards. So, whoever.
Chair Fisher. Ms. Simons.
Yes, Chair Knorr and Representative Gilman. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for the question. So some of the technology supports that potentially could be used and or could be strengthened would be at, you know, it's not, I'm going to use the word point of service, right? So the point of service where an older adult would either go to attend a congregate dining site or where a volunteer or a staff member might deliver a meal. We can use technology to track and verify that service delivery, and we do have needs in Minnesota to improve use of technology in that way. There can be other uses of technology that an individual provider could use in-house, right, to improve their own technology systems. So technology is a, you know, is a part of service delivery, and we can't, you know, we need to use technology for efficiency so that we can keep strong records.
And thank you. And so just a quick follow-up. And when you talked about delivery of meals and things like that, are you talking like EVV, like electronic verification, vehicle verification?
Ms. Simon.
Chair and Representative Gilman. That would be, that's a similar concept, you know, where you're, for example, there's one instance in Northwest Minnesota where an area agency on aging, its providers are using barcode scanning, right? So it's verifying the delivery of that meal to that person. So okay. That's one example.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Wonderful. And then just the last follow-up I have is changing the term from, you know, seniors to older adults to help be in compliance or to do things with federal law, or is it just opening up the scope, because it does say it's a senior nutrition program. So I just want to know, are there going to be conflicting things in our statute with that?
Chair Noor and Representative Gilman. Older adult is the preferred term, right? And it did seem like it didn't quite, the broad brush to change the name of the program didn't quite make sense. But to change the statutory language under the program was, a more modest change. There's no requirement in federal law to do so. It's really just recognition of how we're reframing aging in our state, mm-hmm. and not setting seniors aside as a population, and more recognizing the fact that we're all aging and we become older adults and not a separate kind of senior population. It's a stigma reducing a little bit. It helps to move the needle on that change to language.
Question, Gil.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Chair Noor, committee, for the opportunity to present, and I ask for your support for this bill.
All right. Representative Fisher renews the motion that House File 4210 to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We now move to House File 4212. Representative Vanik. Representative Vanik moves the House File 4212 to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, I see you have an A1 amendment. Representative Vanik moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment?
It's a technical amendment, so.
Very well. Member discussion on A1 amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor of A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is now adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and members of the committee. Before you is House File 4212, a bill brought forth by the Minnesota Department of Health. This bill contains four proposals from MDH to strengthen protections for older adults and vulnerable adults living in assisted living and long-term care settings. Article 1, supplemental, I'll walk you through it, and Article 1 talks about supplemental nursing services agency survey compliance. It clarifies that providers must provide requested documentation to MDH, allows enforcement action if a facility refuses to provide required records, supports timely compliance, and strengthens protections for residents receiving care. Article 2 is a chapter cleanup of 144D. It removes outdated references to Chapter 144D, which are no longer relevant after the transition to assisted living licensure framework under Chapter 144G. It is a technical cleanup to ensure Minnesota statutes remain accurate and easier to implement. Article 3 addresses restraints in assisted living. It establishes clear standards for governing the use of restraints in assisted living facilities, limits restraint use to emergency situations involving imminent risk of harm, requires documentation, reporting, and staff training. It strengthens resident protections while supporting safety and dignity. Article 4 involves a change of ownership. It clarifies responsibility when assisted living or home care facilities change ownership, ensures new licensees assume responsibility for existing fines and correction orders regardless of the date of violation, prevents regulatory gaps during ownership transition, ensures residents remain protected even when facility ownership changes. And with that, I have technical assistance, and we are open for any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Timian, Director Timian. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Timian. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Health. I am just here if there are questions.
Very well. We have Ms. Rodina, please welcome to the testify table and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Good morning, committee members. My name is Pariche Rudina. I'm with the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care here today with on behalf of the Consumer Advocates Coalition and in support of HF 4212, particularly Article 3 is what I'll discuss this morning. Thank you, Rep. Fernig, for authoring this bill. Currently, there's no guidance at all in 144G on restraints usage. This means providers don't have clear direction on what to do and what to avoid, and residents don't have a clear understanding of their rights related to restraints usage. HF 4212 solves this problem by finally providing that clear guidance. Please note that assisted living facilities are an outlier. Restraints guidance is in statute across the care sector. Residents have reported many concerns about restraints to advocates. A resident on hospice reported being given so much morphine and Ativan that after being able to stop taking these medications, their health improved so much that they no longer needed hospice care. This bill aims to prevent this kind of chemical restraint. A resident wanted to use a Mary walker, a tall walker, for exercise and mobility. The facility initially refused, citing the assistive device as a restraint. After seeking clarification with the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, the facility relented and the resident was able to resume their exercise and experience greater independence. This bill supports providers by differentiating between ordered treatment or therapeutic use of a device and an unallowable restraint. Another resident has a doctor's order for a bed rail. The facility has removed the resident's bed rail and stated that they have a no restraints policy at the facility. This bill would again differentiate between ordered treatment and restraint usage. These are common examples that advocates hear about from residents and families and demonstrate why HF 4212 is needed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify? Seeing none, member conversation. Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for this opportunity to ask a couple questions. So when you, the section about, oh my goodness, I just had it, the rails, on the bed rails, where is that?
Ms. Timmons.
Article 3. Oh, sorry, Article 3. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Article 3.
Okay, and it's, thank you, Chair.
Ms. Kim.
So does it talk about that you can use them if it's ordered by a professional? Is that what, okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, this is just really to add clarity. The current statute for these facilities is just silent altogether. So as we heard from the Ombudsman's office, it can cause confusion for residents and for the providers.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Okay, thank you, Chair. And also, residents can also, you know, at the end of their life, also be in a state of confusion. And when we talk about chemicals, you know, medications to help them when they're on hospice, things like that. So, you know, the support is behind this from, is the long-term care facilities, I mean, like, is there extra training and things that are needed in Section 3 or Article 3, is there extra things needed for this to kind of shore this up to make sure they're.
Director Timmy, Representative Bunning.
Yes, if you look at page 9.1 onward, it does talk about training, the refresher training, implementation, verification. So that's all new.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you so much. I was just curious if, like, the long-term care folks would want to come up to the table to see, like, if their members already include this training, or is this going to be extra above and beyond that we're supportive of? I just, the reason I'm bringing this up is my sweet mother-in-law just passed away this last weekend, and she's been loved on and cared for by so many at Cocato Charitable Trust and at the Cocato Manor. And it was, you know, it was very tough to watch the end of her life because she suffered a stroke. And I used to be a CNA, and things have changed from back in the day to now. And I think of just, you know, caring for a loved one and seeing them struggle, and to see the people that were there taking care of her, I would just hate to put more undue burden on things that they already do. And at times, like, I just wished we could have had a rail on the side of her bed. I wish that could have been there, because that's a protection for her. it's, you know, a security for her. And I know in the past there had been a few incidences of folks that kind of got wedged down and they were kind of pinned, you know, this is back in the day, and so they were taken away. And I just think it sure would have been nice. That would have given me more comfort when I would leave in the middle of the night to go back home, knowing that she could be secure on that side. So when these use of restraints are here, I just want to make sure that all of our partners are good with this and that it's going to make life easier for those who care for loved ones. So I just want to check in on that. Thanks.
Mr. Rudina.
Chair Knorr, Vice Chair Gilman, I think the situation you're describing is exactly why this language is necessary. Being able to have that comfort of knowing that somebody has that balance between treatment that actually is therapeutic and supportive to a resident, so in this case a bed rail that would be helpful, as opposed to something that functions to restrain somebody or prevent movement in a way that can be very traumatizing to a resident. We want to be able to have that supportive assistive device, but not cross that line into a restraint that's harmful to the person. And I think this language, by actually identifying ordered treatment as something that is not part of a prohibited restraint, helps walk that line.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And again, I think, yeah, definitely, there's going to be need to have some work done in that section or that article or that area of I'm not comfortable with that because I do believe that the people that are doing the work are going to need to work a little bit more with MDH on how that looks and maybe get some more feedback from them because not all situations are the same. And again, these things that are put in law, if I don't see people at the table that are actually doing the work, that's what that, you know, kind of brings some concern and alarm to me. So. Thank you.
Director Timmy, Representative Bunning.
Well, I believe the long-term care imperative is here, so if you want to hear from them on this, we'd welcome their feedback, or they do have a letter in here as well, so we're willing to work on language if there's concerns.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Great, thank you so much. And just for the record, it does look like there are some concerns, and they do, you know, would like to have some more work done in that area. And again, I would just invite folks that just to bring them into conversations, the ones that are doing the work, the ones that are doing, taking care of our loved ones need to be at the table when we're putting things into law here. So thank you.
I think this bill is continuation from last week, so we should continue having the conversation. Representative Buck.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair. Two questions, Chair. You know, if a facility fails to do this, what's the consequences? You know, they fail to fully document the restraint. And that's, so I have, that's first question with a part B, and then does MDH have the staff to oversee that this documentation does get done correctly?
Director Timian.
Mr. Chair, members, Committee Representative Backer, it would just be part of our regular enforcement survey and inspection work. I do have subject matter staff, if you would like to hear from them, to speak to what all that includes, but it wouldn't add to our other workload. It's just a part of our existing work that we have to do when we inspect these facilities.
Okay. So follow up, if someone fails to do this, document the restraint and so forth, what are the penalties?
Director Timian.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, I think I would need staff to like.
You can phone a friend. So
yes,
they can
to
show.
Speak to the actual. I can't speak to what the.
Thank you.
I can't speak to the details of what that actually
looks fair.
Like.
You can phone a friend, or an enemy. It's up to you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with the response.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Matthew Heffron. I'm an Assistant Division Director at the Health Regulation Division. And we already receive complaints regarding restraint use in assisted living facilities, so this bill would give us a framework for responding to those and doing that work in a more consistent manner. Right now, the way the penalties for that would work is if there is a violation of this statute, we would issue correction orders to the facility. They would have an opportunity to correct that issue, and if they failed to do so, a fine would be imposed that would be based on the level of harm to the resident. So between $500 and $5,000, depending upon the level of harm.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question pertains to the inherited liability. So as an optometrist, our professional liability insurance covers us for claims that would emerge after we would ever retire or wind down our clinic. So it's a rider in a professional liability insurance policy that would cover claims that would emerge after the clinic would wind down. I wonder if there would be a way that if you could tweak the wording of this proposed legislation to say one or the other, either a policy in place that covers those claims that emerge after a wind down, or the liability would be assumed by anyone who would reopen even under a new corporation, new name. How about that for consideration? It might facilitate the sale of the clinic or the assisted living facility and not like scare away any prospective buyers if that policy was in place. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Timia.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know exactly all the pieces of that. I'm hoping that someone from the team can join me to explain that part. But I do know that the intention behind the change of ownership clarifications is that often what we're seeing is that facilities are being bought and there's no way to know who owns it or who is responsible. So this is really just to have clarity to that piece. But I'm joined by a colleague who can speak more to, again, how this actual process works and
Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the response.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Gasiak, and I am an operations manager here at the Minnesota Department of Health. And really what we're trying to do with the change of ownership clarifications is to align with also the federal requirements in the state operations manual. So we get a lot of questions about who is responsible for existing penalties and fines. And what we really want to do is clarify that for the public and for our licensees. And so having more clarity around those being assigned to the new owner would be helpful to the licensees. These aren't new fines. They're existing fines already, and these are not revenue generating. For the department, they go into a special revenue fund.
All right. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for this. I'd asked if I can't say the O word, though. Thank you. Someone help me. I trip over it all the time. It's very embarrassing. It's really awful, actually. I've been working on it for 20 years. I still can't get it. So I just have a quick question. I'm hearing a lot of people who are MDH, who are, you know, there's a letter from the long-term imperative about, you know, their one concern is about if people choose to use it and it's not ordered. So I just have a follow-up question because typically you are all very supportive of individual choices. And so is there anything in this bill that says if someone wants to choose something, they can't choose it?
Ms. Rodina.
Chair Knorr, Representative Hicks, no, there's nothing here that would prevent individual choice. And I think because person-centered planning is a key part of assisted living licensure and is in statute, there is an avenue for informed choice, informed consent, and for that to be documented in a resident's record so that the facility has the protection they need if somebody is choosing, for example, a bed rail that may not be recommended for a particular individual's needs. So that protection, I think, is already in statute.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification because when we talk about restraint, the key part about restraint is it's not a choice. Like the word restraint means someone else did it to you, right? You're being subdued by someone else, by another chemical, by mechanics, by something. It's not a choice. And so that's why I was confused about the conversation because I was like, well, restraint means it's not your choice. People don't usually choose to restrain themselves. But you can choose to have safety precautions that would be considered a restraint under statute. And so I didn't think anything in this bill took away that choice, but I really wanted to clarify because I never want to take away the choice of people to make decisions about their their situations. So thank you.
Anyone wanted to respond? Seeing that, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the exemption for training requirements. And so if you have a formal policy prohibiting the use of restraints, you're exempt. Can you just comment a little bit on that?
Director Timmy. Mr. Heffron.
Thank you, Chair. The purpose of the exemption is related specifically to emergency use of manual restraints. And so the provider would be given the choice of, if you're serving a population where that is a possibility that you would need to engage in that manual restraint, which is, you know, literally putting your hands on someone to restrain them, you would be required to provide training to individuals on how to safely do that without injuring themselves or the resident. However, if you were serving a population or you didn't believe that was a need, you could choose to prohibit that type of restraint, and then you would not be required to provide training on that. It doesn't change the prohibition regarding the mechanical and chemical restraints, just the manual restraints.
Representative,
Mr. Chair. So what are the legal and safety expectations for staff who have not undergone any training?
Mr. Heffer.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Legal implication for those who are not trained.
If an individual is not trained to provide that type of restraint, and they do so anyway, we would evaluate it under the Minnesota Vulnerable Adults Act definition, which states that unreasonable confinement of a person is abuse. And so we would be looking at it, was it reasonable in the scope of the circumstances? If they were responding to an emergency and protecting someone's safety or defending themselves from aggression, that's not abuse. If they were doing it for their own convenience or out of some type of aggressive intent, that person would be found responsible for abuse.
Representative.
Yeah, I'm just hoping it doesn't open people up to undue liability, too, by being part of the exemption. The other part of my question then would be, is what happens to the reporting? You know, you have reporting due to the commissioner, and so does that exempt them from any reporting then, too?
Mr. Heffron.
Thank you. The requirement for reporting is based on a federal requirement to collect information about restraint use in settings that are funded through home and community-based services funding. And so part of the purpose is just to collect what's the frequency of use of this type in this setting. The facility would also still be required to report under the Vulnerable Adults Act if they believed that the incident had crossed the line into abuse.
Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for this discussion. I'm going to come back to, if the ombudsman could come up really quick so I could just ask a quick question around chemical restraint. You did mention a story about a woman, I believe, that was on hospice and that she was able to get off of hospice and she felt better once the medications that she was provided at the time. Again, hospice care is end-of-life care, and she was able to graduate off of that care. But part of end-of-life care could mean so many different things, with medications to music to all kinds of things. So I just want to know, how does that, when it talks about imminent risk, how does that interplay with what's proposed today? Folks that are, you know, that is a normal process of hospice care. Again, like I got to see with my sweet mother-in-law, if that medication was not available, I can't imagine how she would have suffered. We suffered watching her. And if this comes into play in sections 2, 3, and 4, where we talk about restraint not being their choice, part of her choice was to be at peace, you know? So will this interfere with people's normal practice in hospice?
Ms. Rudina.
Chair Knorr, Vice Chair Gilman. No, this should not interfere with the normal practice of hospice care. The MD who is overseeing a person's care in hospice would be making that prescription for, it's often morphine, for residents who are on hospice. What I think this language does is, again, kind of separates the two pieces between what is actually chemical restraint when family, for example, report that their person appears to be, if you'll pardon my use of the slang, snowed. They're not their usual self. They're lethargic. They aren't responding the way they would typically. That's an indication that somebody may be chemically restrained. In this particular example that I discussed, that was part of what was happening. The individual wasn't responsive to family in a way that you can be, even with a significant pain reliever. And so I think there is a distinction to be made between chemical restraint and appropriate hospice care for an individual who needs that pain management.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you. And then one more follow-up. The face-down position, I have not looked that up, but in some instances when people are suffering like pneumonia, or when we had folks that were in the hospital with COVID pneumonia and things like that, part of their recovery, or could be, is that they are face down, that people would be spending time on their stomachs because you open up parts of your lungs for breathing. So I don't know if the face down position restraint, is it that they just can't be on their stomachs, or is that a certain type of restraint? I don't know.
Director Timian or Ms. Rudina or someone from MDH?
I can start, Chair Noor.
Ms.
Thank
Rudina.
You. Vice Chair Gilman, the prone position is for the prone restraint, so it would be a staff person who is holding a person on their stomach. It wouldn't necessarily be somebody in the situation you're describing.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. We're learning a lot today.
All right. Hopefully we can resolve and have the long-term imperative and those who are concerned to get together with the team so we can have at least some discussion on this by tomorrow, hopefully. So with that, your closing remarks, Representative Van.
Thank you. House File 4212, as amended, in a nutshell, updates and clarifies regulations around long-term care providers. And as you can see, there's maybe a little work that needs to be done. I just appreciate your support. Thank you.
I hope it can be done quickly. Rupert Zvanik renews the motion that House File 4212 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion. And the next bill we have is House File 4464. Chair Fisher. Representative Fisher moves House File 4464 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed with the introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor, committee. I'd first like to move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment is some more continued technical updates and some more additional program integrity measures that are being added in.
Representative Fisher moves the A1 amendment. If you can briefly explain the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is some additional technical updates, and it adds in a couple more program integrity measures. Thank you, Chair Noor, committee. This was a major presentation that we had last week on behavioral health. The department was in explaining the bill. Basically, in quick summary, it does a number of things. There's technical updates in here. There is some statutory cleanup and additional accountability measures. We're updating the advanced care directives as discussed during mobile crisis response, clarifying that tribal licensed SUD programs may provide recovery support services, updating psychiatric providers' requirements for intensive rehabilitative mental health services are a couple of the items that are also in there. At this point, I would open it up for more detailed questions.
Any other one in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions? Anybody? None. So, Chair Fisher, to your closing remarks.
Thank you, committee, for the opportunity to present the bill. I hope it will become part of the overall bill, and I would renew my motion that House File 4464 as amended be laid over.
House File 4464 as amended is laid over. Now we move to the final few bills, which I hope is going to go quickly. Good morning, Madam Chair. So I have House File 4549. That is the bill that we didn't get to. So this is the agency bill. I would like to move that House File 4549 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Sounds good. Do you want to just go right to testifiers, or do you want to go over the bill?
I will ask my testifier to go over the bill.
Go ahead, Ms. Schmidt. Introduce yourself for the committee and begin.
Thank you, Chair Keeler and members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Homelessness, Housing, and Support Services Administration at DHS. Here to do a quick walkthrough of the Homelessness and Housing Policy Bill. I believe you have a summary and a bill index in your packet, so I'll use that as a guide. And I'll note that there are six overall proposals that are included in this packet. The first, Section 1, is a technical correction to the Projects for Assistance in Transition from Homelessness program, also known as PATH. This simply clarifies that allowable grant activities include services for individuals with a substance use disorder absent a co-occurring mental illness. When statute was last updated in 2024, there was just an unintentional omission of this phrase, substance use disorder. So this is a correction to align eligible uses with the stated program purpose. It doesn't otherwise change the program. Section 2 is a proposal that amends eligibility criteria for the Housing with Support for Adults with Serious Mental Illness program. This would allow individuals with a substance use disorder diagnosis to qualify for services absent an identified co-occurring mental illness. This is meant to recognize that discerning the behavioral health needs of individuals who are experiencing housing instability can often take time. So this creates a little bit more flexibility for providers and individuals who are seeking services, removing a barrier to access to care and supporting a more integrated person-centered behavioral health approach. The next proposals can be found in sections 3, 5, and 8 and are related to economic assistance programs. These aim to increase program uniformity and remove outdated non-person-centered language in the Minnesota Supplemental Aid and General Assistance programs. More specifically, they would extend the period during which MSA applicants are required to apply for other benefits from 30 days to 90 days. This would align with other state cash assistance programs like General Assistance and MFIP. And it would also eliminate language requiring mandatory vendor payments of General Assistance benefits for individuals with substance use disorder. Right now, individuals with substance use disorder are the only group of individuals that are required to use vendor payments. And what we hear from our county partners is that this can be administratively burdensome, but it's also difficult to implement equitably because it requires financial workers to make assumptions about a person's substance use based solely on their appearance. The next proposal in Section 4 is tied to emergency general assistance. This is responsive to recommendations from the Work Group for Expediting Rental Assistance and simply asks agencies to share their EGA policies with the department so that they can be published in a central location. Right now, agencies establish their own program rules for the program, which means that depending on where you live in the state, you might face different requirements for applying. This is meant to increase transparency and make sure that Minnesotans, regardless of where they live, can understand the services and assistance available to them and the process for receiving it. The next proposal in Section 6 is specific to housing support. This would add new requirements for agencies to post and report on the process by which they review and approve housing support agreements with providers. This was really in response to conversations with providers, clients, and many members of the legislature about concerns regarding local discretion for entering into housing support agreements with providers. We also know that there are concerns about local capacity, need for services, and capacity to make sure that there are program integrity measures for oversight as well. This proposal, I would say, is very much one step towards a longer conversation to make sure that we have the data needed to have really informed conversations with partners, including all of you, about additional reforms that might be needed for the program to make sure that individuals who are eligible can access it while also maintaining program integrity. And finally, Section 7 and 8 propose repealing statutory requirements for the department to produce the Homeless Youth Act report, which also includes reporting on shelter-linked mental health. In recent years, we have seen more national and statewide data sources become available, including the Point in Time Count, the Minnesota Homeless Study, as well as various academic resources that have really replaced this report as a more comprehensive, up-to-date resource for information on youth homelessness. And what we've heard from our partners as well is that the report is no longer their go-to source of information. So this is more about avoiding duplication and recognizing that there may be other more efficient ways that the department can continue to report on information about those programs, distribution of funds, grantee information, absent the formal legislative report. And Chair Keeler, that is the policy bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any members from the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. None. I want to just make one comment about the repealer, especially on the part with the Homeless Youth Act. I push back on that. I have pushed back on that because the assumption that the homeless study is going to be ongoing is not fair because it only has one-time funding. That's what we agreed to in the last budget. So the idea that the agency wants to eliminate a report and say on the record that it's because we're going to go off of another report that doesn't have ongoing funding, I think is a little bit not accurate. And the point in time count is one day. It looks at your community one day. And a lot of communities that I talk to actually don't even know about the point in time count and how every agency in their community and their county is supposed to work on that to get the most accurate data. So I just want that on the record that I don't agree with the repealer on that. I think it's important for our agency to provide information around the funding that we provide you and not assume that other people are going to continue to do that work without ongoing funding. Thank you. Any other member discussion? Seeing none. Oh, Gilmore.
I love the Gilmore girls.
Okay.
I love it.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Hi. That's a good name. All right. Thank you, Chair. Again, general assistance. We're adding in substance use to that. And then, so what are some of the guardrails or things that we're going to have or ways that you're going to be able to know that people are doing treatment? They're, you know, if they're in ongoing things, I'd be curious to know. I'm excited that we're going to help support, you know, folks on their recovery path. But as they're in that situation, how do we encourage just information coming back and forth so we know that they're not going to just stay in a space like, you know, sober homes are different than what this is going to be here. So I'm just curious about, we're adding in substance use disorder. What is the framework around some of that?
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is the initiative we took last year when we moved the housing support to be administered by the agency to support the individuals who have got substance use disorder. So this language just changes. There are two sections, if you look at that, so it just makes sure that it's clear that substance use disorder is separated from the continuity of other care. I'll let my testifier add additional information.
Ms. Schmidt?
Sure. Chair Keeler, Representative Gilman, just want to clarify as well that individuals who currently experience substance use disorder are already eligible for the program, so it's not changing eligibility for general assistance. And I agree, I think there are other touch points throughout the services continuum, whether that's working with the financial caseworkers who are continuing to do like a revalidation of a person's enrollment while also assessing like other needs and connecting to them to the services and support. So the eligibility for the program itself may not be like the best measure to deem like ongoing support, but it is making sure that there are the wraparound services and comprehensive programs that the individual is being connected to.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one comment I would like to make, and for sure would love to hear your response. I love to hear that our testifiers come in and talk about program integrity. And to all of us in the room, what that means is we're safeguarding these programs against fraud, waste, and abuse. And I hope we look at this, you know, if you were going to create an antivirus for your computer, anti-malware, it's going to be dynamic. Because new threats emerge, new hackers come at you continuously on your computer, And I sure hope that the program integrity work that we do is also dynamic, because we'll have emerging threats, we'll have new and innovative ways to try to have fraud, waste, and abuse. So I hope that whatever we're doing in these programs, we also have a really dynamic approach, a proactive approach to emerging threats to program integrity. Thank you.
I'm seeing, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Chair Keeler. My question has to do with just the counties. Have you talked to the counties about what the added reports and added processes requirements are going to mean to them for time? And have you gotten any input back from them on what they think the cost might be?
Ms. Schmidt?
Chair Keeler and Representative, yes, we have been engaging with counties about these proposals. We have not received any opposition. The way that the department is approaching these and continuing to discuss with the counties is really meant to be minimally burdensome. So the reporting on the emergency general assistance, for example, once a year would be simply sharing a policy so that the department could make sure that that's available more publicly. When it comes to the reporting that we're discussing for the housing support program, I think given the increased attention on that program in recent years, there is a strong desire to make sure that we're working together to have informed conversations. So this too can be flexible in what that reporting looks like. It is something that we're open to more conversations with the counties and others about what that looks like to make sure that it's not adding burdens or costs, but really is with the intent of making sure that we can have informed conversations rather than enforcing mandates or making changes that may have more unintended consequences or costs.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, thank you. With regard to outcomes then, what kind of feedback have you gotten from them on what this program will do in terms of outcome?
Ms. Schmidt?
Chair Keeler and Representative, could you clarify, are you referring to outcomes for the housing support program specifically?
Yeah, just for this additional program, what it'll mean, if they give any response and said, oh, this is really good, or are they concerned about the outcomes versus the added work? Is there anything you can tell us about how those conversations went?
Ms. Schmidt.
Chair Keeler and Representative, yes, I think in this case, we know that there's been a lot of conversation about a desire to make sure that we are expanding access to housing support to anybody who might be eligible. And I think there's a natural tension between making sure that individuals who are eligible have access while also having conversations about what that means for our provider network and making sure that we have an adequate network of providers who are also like trained and qualified to provide those services. So the reporting here would really be looking at, again, the process for enrolling those providers as housing support providers, but also looking at instances where, like, if an agreement is denied, for example, what were the reasons leading up to that? Is it something where more support or technical assistance training is needed for the providers themselves, or are there other reasons that the agencies are strategically denying? Maybe there isn't deemed to be a necessity for additional providers. Maybe there are questions about the person's qualifications or ability to appropriately provide services. So it really is looking more at the provider entry into the network and making sure that we have a strong, trained, qualified network of providers to serve individuals.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, Chair Nord, your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would like to renew my motion that House File 4549 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
House File 4549 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Moving on to 4546, it's a Chair Knorr bill as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 4447 to be re-referred to the General Register.
4546.
Sorry. I think the, we're starting with the focus. I'm sorry, I've got two bills here. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 4546 to the Ways and Means.
Sounds good, Chair Knorr, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask Mr. Berg to work us over on the focused program adjustments.
Mr. Berg, introduce yourself to us and continue with the walkthrough.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Doug Berg. I'm the fiscal analyst that staffs this committee and the Children and Families Committee. This is the annual forecast adjustments article, which includes all of the forecast adjustments in the jurisdiction of this committee, the Health and Human Services Committee, where I believe it's going to be heard informationally this afternoon, and the Children and Families Committee, which was also hearing it this afternoon. It simply makes the changes to forecasted appropriations in this jurisdiction, it implements those changes. So in effect, it implements the forecast that came out 3 weeks ago or so. It's from all the changes to forecasted programs from the end of the 2025 session to the current February forecast projection. And it has no policy in it. It is a purely technical matter that we do every year to implement the forecast. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Thank you for all of your work to get us even here to these bills. We don't have any other testifiers. Did anybody from the public wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Chair Knorr, final comments on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a good bill, so we shall refer to the Ways and Means.
Chair Knorr renews his motion for House File 4546 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 4647 is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. 4546. House File 4546 is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Dyslexic. Both. Okay, last bill, we're moving to House File 4447. Chair Knorr, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would like to re-refer this and place it on the general register. I do have an A1 amendment. I would like to move the A1 amendment, and the A1 amendment changes the dates from September 1 to November 30th.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Chair Knorr, no testifiers for your... Oh, you do? Oh, hi.
I do have a testifier.
Go ahead, Mr. Berg. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, this is a project that has grown out of the last year or so. Members who've been here for a while will realize that the human services bills and the children and families bills do not rider the grant-based appropriations, where most parts of the budget do actually show the grant base in each case in the bill. The Senate made an attempt last year to implement this and couldn't do it during the midst of a main budget year. The reviser of statutes has kind of also pushed this project along as they're increasingly uncomfortable that there are no legal citations in many areas where we have grants appropriated. What this bill does is require that the Department of Human Services, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and the Department of Health produce a report by November 30th that shows the grant base for fiscal years 28 and 29 in all cases and proposed rider language so that the 27 legislature can, if it chooses, rider-based grant appropriations so that you'd be able to see them in the bill. This bill only requires a report from those agencies to the legislature and MMB. And that's the whole bill.
Chair Knorr, anything you want to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume there was a recent report that was sent to the nonpartisan staff from the agency.
Madam Chair and Representative Knorr, there is last year the Health and Human Services bill directed the agencies to produce a grant report that simply lists the grants. This actually requires them to update that information for the next biennium and to propose legislative riders in the case of each grant. So there was a report that came in on the grant base. This actually requires them to update that and produce draft legislation.
Okay. Any members from the public wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion? Okay. Chair Noor, final comments on your bill?
No final comment. Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion, House File 4447, as amended to be re-referred to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 4447, as amended, is placed on the General Registry. Chair Schumacher, is there anything you want to add for the next meeting?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It should be a humdinger.
We get to be back here at 8:15. This committee is adjourned.